Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hi there. I'm Dexter Fergie, and you're listening to New Books in Intellectual History. Thank you very much for joining us. Today I'll be speaking with Jason Josephson Storm about his fascinating new book called The Myth of Disenchantment, Magic, Modernity, and the Birth of the Human Sciences. It was published this year by the University of Chicago Press. The book tackles the commonly held belief that modernity produces disenchantment. With the rise of science and scientific reasoning, so the traditional argument suggests, beliefs in spirits, myths, and magic fall away. The icy slopes of logic do not welcome enchantments. Yet, as the myth of disenchantment illustrates, this narrative is wrong. Some of the most persuasive and articulate champions of the Enlightenment were themselves enthralled with enchantments. The classic example is, of course, Isaac Newton, who was both natural philosopher and alchemist. But more surprisingly, some of the logical positivists of the Vienna School were also interested in and believed in the paranormal. What Josephson Storm argues is, as he puts it, we should be less surprised than we usually are to find scientists of all stripes keeping company with magicians. Disenchantment is the myth of modernity. To argue this, he provides a rereading of Western thought from modernity's alleged origins in 17th century Europe up to the Vienna School in the 20th century. Each chapter explores how a particular discipline, including philosophy, folklore studies, sociology, religious studies, and psychoanalysis, interacted with the occult and the mystical. He also shows how some of those disciplines helped cultivate and spread the myth of disenchantment. It is an impressive book that utilizes archives from across Europe and uses texts in many languages, and it is filled with interesting and sometimes shocking stories and rich with challenging and persuasive arguments. It tracks the history of the human sciences, so scholars from across the human sciences would benefit greatly from reading The Myth of Disenchantment. I hope you enjoy our discussion. I'm here with Jason Josephson Storm to talk about his new book, The Myth of Disenchantment. Welcome to the show, Jason.
Hey, it's great to be here.
Yeah, I really enjoyed your book. You weave together a really wonderful assortment of surprising and sometimes strange actors to tell a really compelling and interesting story about modernity and the human sciences. So thank you for writing it, firstly.
Yeah, thanks.
So the first question that I have for you is, how did you come to religious studies?
How did I come to religious studies? I guess I came to religious studies already as an undergraduate. And at the time, when I went to undergrad, I was pretty open at what I wanted to do. I wasn't sure if I wanted to do creative stuff. I was in a rock band and playing a lot of music, or if I wanted to do something more scholarly. And for me, I ended up becoming like a film major first. And I was shooting music videos with a band and just trying to sort of write screenplays. I wanted to be a film screenplay writer, but I was looking for like content for my screenplays. And I decided just sort of on a whim to take an intro theory and method course in religious studies at Amherst, but taught by this old guy named Jack Pemberton III, who was some kind of weird relic from a weird like sort of colonial era version of anthropology. But the course is really fabulous, and the issues really, really struck me. The sort of methodological or theoretical issues are really, I found really important and influential. And then I sort of stayed in religious studies. I was trying to decide whether I wanted to be in religious studies or philosophy. But the stuff I was most interested in was sort of being exiled from philosophy at that time. So it was like, mostly what I'm thinking of is like Asian philosophy wasn't taken seriously as philosophy. And I was really interested in Buddhism and Confucianism and Taoism. And so that stuff. So in order to study that stuff, I had to really be focusing on a religion major. And then along the way, I was also interested in sort of continental philosophy. And that, although there was some of that being allowed into the philosophy programs where I was an undergrad, there just wasn't much. And so those two sort of excluded forms of philosophy sort of drew me to religious studies, really. And then I just sort of, it took off. I mean, I got, it became, I thought it was sort of a good catch-all discipline that let me do a little bit of history, a little bit of anthropology. I love languages. I've been loving, you know, I grew up bilingual and I just love to do different kinds of language stuff. So, you know, religious studies let me bring these sort of philosophical, anthropological, historical, and philological things all in this one sort of crystallized knot. And then the first thing I sort of did as a major project was to challenge the category religion. So I don't know. It's like I have a weird relationship to it, but I definitely it's a wonderful sort of disciplinary, pan-disciplinary intersection.
Yeah. And I mean, I think all of that comes through in your book. It's an eclectic book, and clearly your background is extremely eclectic. I'm really curious how you reached this book. What exactly led you to writing about the history of modernity and the human sciences, because this is extremely different from your previous work on sort of like Japanese history and religion.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's the same time period and similar methodological issues, but it's really different in its geography. I came to it, like, I was actually in Japan. I talk about this a little at the beginning of the monograph, but I was in Japan at a tattoo parlor called Hara Zanmai and getting some touch-ups done and some tattoos. And when it was in March of 2011, and that was when the Tohoku quake and tsunami happened. And it was really intense to be in the tattoo parlor where there's this, you know, a lot of sort of tragic history unfolding, although we didn't know at the time that it was tragic. But, you know, the tattooing got interrupted, the television came on, and it was like showing video footage of waves and stuff like that. And this was before we knew that there were any casualties, and there are some earthquakes are pretty common in Japan. But everybody stopped tattooing, and we kind of all sort of sat around looking at the television screen, and we started just sort of talking about different stuff. And one of the folks there asked me about my research or what I was doing in Japan. And I told him about this project I was researching at the time on called Death and Resurrection, Shifting Boundaries Between the Living and the Dead in 19th and 20th Century Japan. And at the time, I was trying to sort of push back against the notion that Japanese modernity meant disenchantment. But like when I explained my project to the room, people first, you know, chimed in and talked about different kinds of protective talismans they had, or faith healing experiences they had, or visions, or even we talked a little bit about ghosts. But this one kind of Western guy in the room, who I interpreted as coming from somewhere in Scandinavia, and he like basically said, well, of course, you know, the Japanese people in the room have had these experiences because Japan is the mystic Orient. And, you know, of course, magic never died in Japan, but magic died in the West, was his contention. And I just knew this was wrong. And I was really suspicious of that narrative in general. In part, I knew that many Americans and Europeans believed in ghosts and in protective icons and talismen. And so right after that happened, I ended up leaving Japan, in part because the situation was really not good for research. And I ended up in Germany, and I was kind of going, and I wanted to work on my German in part. So I was going back through the canon of European thought, particularly German sort of social sciences, human sciences, and philosophy, trying to, you know, really enjoying marinating in the original language. And the thing that kept coming up that sort of presented itself to me over and over and over again was the things about ghosts and theosophy and the occult. They kept returning inside the social theorists that I was reading. And so I really became kind of decided to really, you know, reconceive the project. And instead of focusing on Japan, because I felt like that would just reinforce mystical Asia, I decided instead to kind of look at America and Europe through the kind of the eyes of an outsider, with the same kind of gaze that is often leveled at non-Europeans. And then sort of explore the evidence for enchantment in contemporary Europe and North America. And when I did that, the thing that struck me was there's a lot of evidence I rehearsed at the beginning of this book, but sort of sociological evidence that suggests that a lot of people today believe in spirits and ghosts and angels, something like 80% of Americans believe in angels and like 70% believe in demonic possession and people, you know, something like 75% of Americans believe in some form of the paranormal. So all this makes it look like the narrative of disenchantment, as we've told ourselves, doesn't really apply in contemporary America. And I looked at similar data in Western Europe. And so so having seen the way that that narrative didn't hold up in the present, I began to worry about how it held up in the moments that it was theorized. And when you trace the story about modernity as disenchantment back through the archive, it's easy to show that it originated mostly in the 19th century and mostly in Germany, France, and Great Britain. But this is the same period in which all three countries were experiencing their own occult revivals. So spiritualism, table turning, and theosophy was in the lives of the various theorists at the very moment when this notion of modernity as rupture, with this notion of modernity as disenchantment, was itself being first articulated. And so part of the project meant to go back into the archive to look at letters, to look at diaries, and try and see how much these kind of beliefs in psychic powers, magic, astrology, or what have you, entered into the lives of these canonical theorists. And I was really surprised how much I could dig up, basically looking at archives in Germany, Austria, France, and England. So that's sort of how the project sort of took shape. And then at that point, by the time I was done, there was way too much material, even on the European stuff, for me to fit in one book. So I had the Japan stuff fell by the wayside. Yeah.
Wow. So you begin the book with a really interesting and surprising episode involving the Curies, Marie and Pierre Curie, I think you call them paragons of science, participating in a seance. Can you narrate that scene and tease out what the presence and participation of the paragons of science in a seance have for the rest of your book and your overall argument?
Sure. So to kind of retread it from memory a little bit. So basically, the interesting thing is that in early 20th century, so, like right around 1906, 1907, the Curies, particularly Marie Curie, but also her husband, were involved in psychical research. And in particular, they were, and not just them, actually, a bunch of the sort of defining figures of the physics establishment of early 20th century France, people who would go on to win Nobel Prizes, philosophers, physicists, and even doctors, were all really interested in a particular psychic medium or spirit medium, an Italian woman named Eusapia Palladino. And so not just the Curies, but like, people like Gilbert Ballet and Arnaud de Grammont and Charles Richet and Henri Bergson all were doing these seances. And they were trying to figure out if Palladino had real powers. And Marie Curie became convinced ultimately that this particular spirit medium did. And what struck me and the reason I sort of used it to begin the book is that there's this sort of one of the most widespread myths in the history of science is the notion that spirits give way to a law-like cosmology, that basically mechanism will displace vitalism. And in fact, that's the grand trajectory of science. And what I wanted to show was that already at the beginning, I wanted to cast some doubt on this because I'm not trying to either use the authority of the Curies to promote belief in spirit mediums, but nor am I trying to denigrate them. But I'm just trying to say that this notion that seance and science are totally separated doesn't hold and didn't hold for much of history of the last 200 or 300 years. I mean, so in this respect, the fact that, Marie Curie came to believe in the powers of a psychic medium, it's not that unusual, actually. Like, not only did she think that that the psychic medium was real, but, people like William James, the famous pioneering psychologist, also believed in the powers of this particular medium. And so what I wanted to do was show that, physics and spirits, two worlds that are normally seen as separate, are often came to overlap. And this belief in spirit phenomena was not sort of some kind of archaicism left over from the Middle Ages, but was part of this boom in new kinds of, let's say, enchantments that emerge in modernity. So new ways of thinking about the invisible world, that involved belief in psychic powers, but also involved in things in belief in things that we, you know, might ground more seriously, like X-rays and radium, and that this was part of the same conversation in a particular moment. So so part of it was that I wanted to show a kind of notion that within modernity, and I put the word modernity in quotes, magic keeps reemerging, or belief in spirits in an animated cosmos kind of continues to reappear. And so in the introduction, I kind of argue, and here by reference to Bruno Latour, that there's a significant way in which we have never been disenchanted. Mm-hmm. And then for people who already might suspect that we haven't been disenchanted, I then want to argue for how this myth of disenchantment, how this notion that modernity means necessarily disenchantment, emerged and came to function as a kind of guiding narrative or regulative ideal. Yeah.
Perfect. Thank you. Yeah, I really enjoyed the riff on the Latourian, we've never been modern.
Yeah, totally.
So the next question that I wanted to ask that also comes from your introduction is one about methodology or your approach. And so, you know, everyone knows about reflexive sociology, and it's, you know, it's a standard way of doing things in sociology today. But you introduce a new approach that you call reflexive religious studies. What do you mean by that, and why does it matter?
So in a way, I'm inspired by some version of the reflexive sociology literature, particularly thinkers like Bourdieu. But what I'm interested in, so for me, the interesting feature about reflexive sociology for those listeners, particularly in other disciplines, or the aspect of reflexive sociology that interested me, is that sociology has this interesting problem, which is that once you start to note that the act of doing sociology itself transforms a society. In other words, once you start to show that, for example, the way that you describe categories of race on surveys that you make people take changes their orientation and their own sense of themselves as inhabiting categories, you start to have this second problem, which is that sociology itself starts to have an impact on the social field. And you can see this both in the way that sociology gets involved in making government policy, but also in the way in which sociology starts to impact, you know, social identity. So what I wanted to do was articulate a similar kind of move for religious studies, a kind of to emphasize the way in which the study of religion has its own reverberations on the religious field. And it becomes it's a two-directional kind of reverberation. We often want to imagine that the academy is segregated from the field, or that, you know, it has one-directional influence. But one of the things that I want to emphasize is the way that there's a back and forth, a kind of reverberations. And this kind of feedback loop between the study of religion or the academics of religion, not just in religion departments, but in general, and the religious field, you know, means that like trends in the religious world have their impact on religious studies, and religious studies has its impact on trends. So, for example, spiritualism being born in the 19th century, when religious studies was coming to make its own definitional identity as a subdiscipline, was huge, both in the way that spiritualists came to think of themselves, relying on the authority of academic experts, but also ways that scholars themselves, often practicing or engaging with spiritualism, changed the way they read their own history. So like the reconstruction of Gnosticism in early biblical studies was heavily impacted by spiritualism and theosophy, which were booming at the same moment. So to trace this kind of back and forth, I wanted to encourage a model I'm describing as reflexive religious studies, and which traces some of that. And then also it's reflexive, not primarily on the autobiographical level. It's not just about situating you in your research, which is how we've tried to do reflexivity in religious studies for the most part before, but looking at it on a disciplinary level, looking at how the discipline looks, how the study of religion constructs and how things like the narrative of disenchantment themselves start to have effects. They start to either enchant or disenchant, but it then looks at kind of the reverberations of the study of religion on the field, the larger religious field as well. Yeah.
Great. Okay. So on to the next chapter, chapter one called Enchanted Postmodernity. And in this one, you sort of lay out the field of contemporary European and American superstitions of all sorts. And, you know, one feature of the myth of modernity that we tell ourselves is that the West has cast aside its superstitions, whereas the global South still holds on to their superstitions. You know, within the social sciences, a lot of the global South superstitions have been studied quite a lot. I mean, you know, today we know about from your chapter, you talk about how, you know, certain Vietnamese people will appease divinities with cans of Pepsi, for instance. And yet these like modern twists on seemingly traditional superstitions seem normal in the global South. But you make the case, and you've already alluded to it a bit, that Europe and the United States are superstitious as well. And it's a part of the myth that that we tell ourselves. Can you just say a little bit more about contemporary Western enchantments?
Yeah, I mean, I tend to avoid the word superstition as it's a little bit pejorative, but I'll put it in a different kind of a way, which is that, but I think I can get it really the cusp of what you're pointing at. Yeah, I mean, I think we have this story about the West as rational and the other as irrational that people in the social sciences have been telling for a long time, you know, and across the humanities. And, you know, part of this is that it's the academic version of a mystic Asia trope, you know, like the idea is that sometimes, but it's not just, you know, it's not just East Asia, but it's also the global South. So, you know, so people look at developing countries, et cetera. And there've been a lot of anthropological studies. What seems to fascinate anthropologists is often the kinds of so-called bizarre beliefs that so-called primitive peoples believed. And so, you know, there's a lot of anthropologists have accumulated a lot of evidence for things like about, you know, magical charms in Japan or clairvoyant Brazilian spirit surgeons or like, you know, practitioners of Haitian voodoo or, you know, possessed Malaysian factory workers or what have you. But what it turns out is that a lot of the things that we think of as exclusive to the rest of the world outside the West, And we think of the West as different, as rational and materialist. It just doesn't work. That separation, that binary bifurcation doesn't work. There's been some great work also showing already in studies outside of Europe and Asia, looking at how modernity produces its own enchantments. And I'm thinking of the work of Jean and John Komaroff about sub-Saharan Africa, the occult economies in sub-Saharan Africa. But they've noticed that, like, you know, capitalism and witch belief go together in and are amplified together in the South African case. So if we have all this evidence and all this evidence for the kind of things like belief in spirits and magic or whatever outside the West is often either taken as evidence for how India imperfectly modernized is the claim or how, you know, still backward some people are, whatever. But it turns out, like, if you look at that, if you look at the same kind of data in Europe, and you can find the same kind of data in Europe and America. You only have to go to like a co-op to see, like, if I go to my local co-op, I see posters about crystal healing and astrology and you can, and energy work. And, you know, and if you look at, you know, if you interview people, you know, you can see like stuff about tarot reading. All over. And if you look at our television shows and our movies, we have people constantly overflowing with magic, the world that is depicted and described. So on a sort of on a basic sort of ethnographic level, we can see the paranormal or belief in the paranormal all over the place. You can trace it economically. You can look at the fortune tellers, for example, in America and or Great Britain. And you can look at the rise of crystal healing. It's big business. A lot of this stuff is direct capitalist strains to it as well. And so, you know, it's all over the place. And it's on our television shows, so-called reality television, which often has, you know, ghost hunting in it in one way or another. Or you can see people talking about guardian angels or celebrity psychics. And the whole thing seems to have, you know, it's disconnected from the standard narrative of secularization. Some people looking at my book at first pass think that I'm just criticizing the secularization narrative, which has already been, in a way, attacked a lot. And we even have this sort of mystifying term, the post-secular. But what I want to note is that I'm not just looking at belief in religion as such. I'm not trying to argue that something particularly, you know, that Christian fundamentalism is on the way back or something, which was what part of the main argument for the post-secular a decade or two ago. But what I'm noting is that a whole range of beliefs that we associate with, I'll use that word, superstition, continue to be believed in and have a lot of cultural force in Europe and America. And they're disconnected from secularization, depending on how you measure sociologically. But even in countries like Norway, where church attendance is way down and you have many people who are no longer identifying as Christian, you have roughly comparable levels of belief in ghosts. And I look at the statistical evidence for this, and, you know, it's the majority of people basically in both Europe and in America who have some kind of paranormal belief. So skeptics are the minority. It's in both of these countries, or, you know, across basically the countries that I survey in the introduction or in that chapter. So what that's striking to me is that the punitive difference between the West and the rest doesn't hold. And in fact, In that respect, the narrative that European thinkers have told about Europe to justify either European colonial expansion or to bemoan the modernity in Europe just isn't an accurate story. It's like a myth that Europeans have told about Europe that doesn't actually hold. And it's not just that these things came back in the 60s, as a couple of people who observed this pattern have tried to argue. It's, you can see it all the way through from the 19th century to the 20th century. And the beliefs, specific beliefs change. It's psychic powers where it was animal magnetism or and then spirit forces before, but it's, the terminology might shift and there are new enchantments emerging all the time, but it's not the case that we've experienced a grand trajectory of disenchantment. And so that's the kind of work that I look at and do in that chapter, is looking at the present, the enchanted present.
Yeah, I mean, that chapter really reminded me of my teenage years when I was just obsessed with the Eric von Daniken books, like Chariots of the Gods and stuff like that. So moving on to the next chapter, which is, it's called Revenge of the Magicians. Here you look at people such as Isaac Newton and Francis Bacon, who have long been associated with the origins of the Enlightenment and rationality. Really interestingly, you show how they were also fascinated with and believed in a variety of enchantments, alchemy, magic. You even suggest that they saw their project, the Enlightenment project, as a divine science. Yeah. And I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit about Francis Bacon and his own enchantments and what his beliefs and your other actors' beliefs say about modernity.
Yeah, great. So I'll take a step back and just explain why I started the chronology where I did. So the other thing that my book is a big response to is Adorno and Horkheimer's Dialectic of Enlightenment, which is an influential work in Frankfurt School of Critical Theory. And they tell a particular story in which they use this phrase, the disenchantment of the world, die Entzauberung der Welt. And they describe it, and they describe Enlightenment as leading to the disenchantment of the world. And they begin their narrative with Francis Bacon, who for them is like the central figure in the disenchantment of nature, basically. So part of what I wanted to do was go back into their own source data. I mean, I'm a big fan of critical theory. I that's one of the areas in which I was trained. But in this particular case, it doesn't fit the narrative that we've hung on these. These people are supposed to be like either the scapegoats or the heroes of disenchantment. Figures like Isaac Newton, like Giordano Bruno, like René Descartes, like Francis Bacon. And it turns out that they don't fit the received story about them. And so I start with Bacon, although I gesture at the other thinkers whose occult interests perhaps we know a little bit better, like people know about Isaac Newton at this point, for example. But I go through them a little bit, but then I focus in on Bacon. And the interesting thing is Francis Bacon is normally described as the father of modern science. He's supposed to be at the origin of the Enlightenment. Francis Bacon gets attacked for supposedly saying knowledge is power, although I retranslate the Latin and have a different reading of that phrase. People from Adorno and Horkheimer to Ernst Cassirer all blamed Bacon for the disenchantment of nature in particular, for stripping nature of its occult forces. But if you actually read Bacon, and if you read him more sophisticatedly, you can, in particular, if you read works that are, that aren't the like two works of Bacon that everybody reads or whatever, then what you can see is that he describes his project as magic. It's just literal. He says, I'll bring up the quote, magic aims to recall natural philosophy from a miscellany of speculation to a greatness of works. Which is exactly what he's doing with his project. He's calling for magic. He's not trying to strip magic out of the world. He's trying to make magic less secret. So, and that kind of phrasing occurs multiple times in texts like the De Augmentis. He's calling for an anti-esoteric or anti-occult magic. So in that respect, to see him as a disenchanter is wrong. But the second piece that's even more screwed up about Bacon's posthumous reputation is that people think that he was stripping the nature of vital forces, and they accuse him of, he describes, he's a famous phrase of putting nature to the rack or whatever, torturing nature, which is a sad and depressing metaphor. And there's a whole line of critique on Bacon that blames him for that metaphor and for despiritualizing nature. But those two things go against each other. You can't torture a despiritualized nature. And actually, if you look more sophisticatedly at different scraps of Bacon's writings, you can see, particularly letters and what have you, you can see that he actually described a nature that was full of vital forces. His nature was not a nature that had been stripped of magic, but one that was vibrant. And it was also a divine science, too. That's the other thing. This is something that historians of the period know, and I'm not the first to discover this, but Bacon described it, was it with a kind of radical Protestant, and he described science as the recovery of academic knowledge for the end times. You know, this is Bacon's whole scientific project was a divine project, and it was one about reading nature for divine signs. And then the piece of it that I think, you know, people misread his phrase, knowledge is power. But if you look at the full sentence in which the Latin scientia potestas est occurs, it actually should be translated as God's power is knowledge. So what Bacon is talking about, you know, because we just take that phrase out of context. And what Bacon is talking about is a kind of power by which God comes to know the world. Bacon is also really interested in human knowledge being fallible and broken. And so when Adorno, it's really limited. Bacon thinks that we're like wandering in a labyrinth of the world, which God has given us some clues to, but it is otherwise this mystifying thing in the human mind. He thinks is really screwed up. So when Adorno and Horkheimer accuse Bacon of thinking that the mind and the world have a happy match, that's their phrase, they're just wrong. It's not a good reading of Bacon. So Bacon, we keep having to push. Historians of science like to talk about like the last magician. And the problem is that like we keep having to push the last magician later and later and later and later and later. You know, like people wanted to talk about Isaac Newton as the last magician, or they've earlier talked about, you know, Giordano Bruno. But then we figured out Newton, you know, was an alchemist. We figured out Giordano Bruno was an alchemist. You know, we can keep telling that story all the way from the 17th century to the 21st century. If we want to look at, you know, even just in the hard sciences, even if we want to look in physics or in, the, you know, we can look at the idea of a quantum new age, that quantum physics leads to new age belief. That's in quantum physicists themselves. So, for example, Wolfgang Pauli has his own quantum mysticism. Various readings that Bohr authorized of the Copenhagen interpretation tip that way. I mean, it's true that the lightweight pop culture version of quantum mysticism is a new thing, but there's a reason that Oppenheimer quotes the Bhagavad Gita, "I have become death, destroyer of worlds," when he dropped the atom bomb. It's because one of the ways that quantum physicists and the cutting edge of physics in the 20th century, they look toward Eastern thought often to understand the phenomena that they were encountering. And so what it turns out is even within the hard sciences, you frequently have these returns of enchantment or people who are believing in either different kinds of spiritualized or mystical versions of the cosmos or even kinds of spirits and spirit forces. So you have it even in physics. And then the problem for me then is, okay, well, if we've got it in the scientists, well, maybe scientists are kind of a little weird and quirky and might not know things that happen outside their area of expertise. You would think that social scientists wouldn't make this mistake. But actually, as I show tracing it through the history of the book, you have both the notion that modernity is in disenchanted and enchantment entering into the lives of social theorists as well. So that chapter, I start with Bacon, but I also look at Diderot and D'Alembert and the birth of the Encyclopédie and how they gesture toward both the encyclopedia as a divine science, and they describe a science of spirit. Science of spirits as a positive kind of science, and they gesture toward natural magic. There's a whole generation of beating up the French philosophes for killing God or despiritualizing the world, and it turns out that's not what they were doing. They might have been against institutional churches. That's definitely clear. They were anti-clerical as all get out, but they often had a much messier relationship to things like alchemy, spirits, and even theological knowledge than they've been given credit for. And so part of what I do in that chapter is to recoup it. Again, not to justify it, but to complexify our notion of either scapegoats or heroes. If you're a critique of modernity, you see these guys as the place that things went wrong, and they become scapegoats for all of the despiritualization of nature. And if you're a proponent, a Whiggish historian of progress, you get the people celebrate these guys as the first truly rational people or whatever. But both of those are myths. I mean, if you look at the whole range of figures in the so-called Age of Enlightenment, they don't fit the received image of them, especially if you go into their private lives.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Great. Thank you for that. So the next chapter, chapter three, called The Myth of Absence, it dives into the late 18th century, early 19th century German philosophical world. And it's here where we see a generation that starts to craft and cultivate the myth of a mythless society. And this chapter has really interesting stuff on Friedrich Hölderlin, Hegel, Schiller, And this generation is hugely important for how that myth of the mythless society is transmitted into future generations. Unfortunately, for the sake of time, we're going to have to jump to the next chapter, The Shadow of God. And this one traces the intertwining and parallel origins of religious studies and theosophy. And I was also really obsessed with theosophy as a child. I just remember reading tons of books on Madame Blavatsky. And so I mean, I was just astonished, actually, at the scope of the Theosophy Society. I think in 1928, there were over 1,000 lodges, over 45,000 members, and they operated in over 40 countries. But this chapter isn't just about the Theosophy Society. It's also about thinking about that history and the history of religious studies together. And I was just wondering if you could elaborate why these histories should be read together. And also if you could just elaborate more on why you think or how religious studies itself was not a disenchanter, as some of the more common narratives of your discipline suggest.
Yeah, so there's a standard story in religious studies about its own origins, that we tell ourselves a story that's about how religious studies as an academic discipline came to separate itself from particularly Protestant theology and then to criticize it. And so usually people either criticize religious studies for being basically Protestant in its presuppositions, or they criticize religious studies for being kind of anti-religious. Like that's our sort of self-critique. But it turns out if you look at the cultural context of the founding figures of religious studies, and I'm talking about people like Friedrich Max Müller E.B. Tyler and company, that's not the world that they're living in. They're not living in a mainstream Protestant world, nor are they trying to kill off religion as part of their project. Instead, what's striking is that that religious studies is born alongside theosophy, the Theosophical Society, as a kind of huge transnational new religious movement. And there's a lot of overlap between the early who's who of religious studies and these kind of Western esoteric or theosophical movements. And, you know, so we have Max Müller, for example, who, you know, the founder of the discipline, who calls at one time wanted to call religious studies theosophy as his title. And he articulates in a series of lectures he gave very late in life his version of a kind of mystic Christianity as the core of what religious studies was supposed to be doing. In that respect, so in that respect, the project he's calling for is very different. And the context, you have to understand that, or people have to understand in my field, that a lot of the people we've canonized had sort of odd views on religion. They were pioneers in religious studies, in part because they had interesting and fresh things to say. And they were often parts of different kinds of, unusual different kinds of religions themselves. They were at the margins in different respects. And for Max Müller, he was drawn toward theosophy in a particular way, and drawn toward a kind of what he saw as Hindu mysticism as the core of the project. And also, you know, so I have that evidence from recollections of people after his death, as well as some of his published writings. And then I also have, in that chapter, I talk about E.B. Tyler, who's famous for founding the theory that animism is the origin of religion. And what you discover is that, and for him, animism is belief in spirits. And what's interesting is that he thinks of that as the origin of religion, but in his own day, spiritualism is huge, table turning and seances and what have you. And then, as I note in that chapter, he actually went to spiritualist seances. So he was checking it out, and he wasn't totally convinced one way or the other. But the thing that he was describing as the most primitive was actually something he saw in his own social world. So he then had to figure out how to fit that into his theories. Like, what do you do when elite British society is going to seances when he's come to understand belief in spirits as the defining feature of the primitive mind? And what I want to say is that when he's talking about the primitive, he's seeing his own society more than he is seeing this other world, whether he claims to be talking about Mexico or what have you. And it also turns out that he read a lot in Western esoteric materials himself. So he formulated a theory of magic. And at this part, I buried in the footnotes because this chapter was getting too long. But Tyler himself read a lot of spell books. He was reading Western magical texts and using stuff from these Western magical traditions to theorize what he thought of as primitive magic. So there's a way in which this kind of esoteric milieu functioned as a buffer between Europe and Asia. So when European thinkers were constructing an imaginary Asia, they were often doing so through the intermediaries of people who were themselves magical practitioners in Europe claiming to recover Eastern thought. So theosophy was presenting itself as Buddhism, and some people took it at its word and thought that it had insights in Buddhism, especially early figures in the history of religious studies. And one of the points of that chapter is to show how the social worlds of theosophy and early religious studies collapse. And I show theosophists, they knew each other. They went to some of the same social events and hung out with each other and exchanged letters and met each other. And I extract a particular French magician named Eliphas Lévy, who was like the most important person in the French occult revival. And I show how he's only, is only one social click away from people like Mueller, and how he was, Eliphas Lévy had a huge influence on both religious studies in a way, in a cryptic way, and on theosophy and on magical traditions as well. And then I also recoup Madame Blavatsky and Helena Blavatsky and the birth of the Theosophical Society. And I just show, just in addition to sheer numbers in that society, a ton of influential early figures in religious studies happened to be members or were members of the Theosophical Society. And I provide a limited list of that, which I can't reconstruct from memory, but you can look at in the chapter in question. But it turns out that there's significant institutional overlap between the Theosophical Society and the Society for the Scientific Study of Religion in that particular moment in the late 19th and early 20th century.
Great, thank you. So the next chapter, chapter 5, called The Decline of Magic, J.G. Fraser. This chapter walks us through an often forgotten yet extremely significant human science in the 19th century, folklore studies. You focus specifically on James Fraser, who is a Scottish folklorist, who you argue is actually the first to formulate the classical disenchantment thesis. Can you just briefly tell us who James Fraser was and perhaps why he's so often forgotten?
Yeah, so James George Fraser was born in 1854, and he lived until 1941, if I remember right. And so he's most famous for a text called The Golden Bough. And The Golden Bough is this weird, mad sort of exploration of a particular ritual, basically pagan, Italian pagan ritual. And he uses it he starts from there and does this vast comparative project. And it's a book, it started as like one book basically, and then expands to be like a huge multi-volume study that brings in just about everything in the world into this, sort of narrative, sort of folkloric, Fraser's was a transit classicist, so it merges classics and folklore studies to argue about the kind of persistence of pagan belief in Western Europe in his period. And so he builds this grand story into The Golden Bough, and it was a hugely read, widely cited work. We no longer read it in religious studies, but he was, but people like Freud and Fraser. Not just Fraser, Freud and Max Weber and Wittgenstein all read The Golden Bough, and they really sort of bought into Fraser's description of history and the nature of ritual and in the grand trajectory of modernity. And the interesting thing is that it's in Fraser, in one of the late editions of The Golden Bough, not the first edition, where he formulates an early version of a story that describes the evolution of human thought from magic to religion, to science. It's like a three-phase evolutionism. In the earlier German romantic materials, I talk about the formulation of this phrase, the death of God, and I talk about the history of this phrase, die entgottete Natur, the despiritualized nature, what have you. And those are really important, but none of them describe a kind of three-phase evolutionism that you find in Fraser. And admittedly, Fraser is adapting from the French sociologist Auguste Comte, but Auguste Comte didn't have magic as the starting point of the grand trajectory of civilization. And so this phrase, Fraser then gets read and picked up in all these different places. The Golden Bough becomes this quite defining text in, because people think of it as an insight into the primitive mind and into primitive beliefs in so-called magic and what have you. So he was, really influential in his own day, but we basically don't read him anymore. Hmm. Yeah.
Great. The final chapter in the first part of your book, chapter 6, called The Revival of Magic, Aleister Crowley. And I really, really love this chapter, mainly because Crowley's, he's just such a perfectly strange person. And he gets up to some impressively strange antics, you know, like crucifying a frog or performing like trance rituals on his honeymoon in Cairo. And yet he's also extremely significant to your story. And I just wanted to alert listeners to this this chapter and what it contains, because this is a magician who is really reading the human sciences. He's reading people like Fraser, and he's somehow turning the Golden Bough into a spell book, basically. And there's just so many interesting stories in this chapter, and I really encourage readers to read it. And let's move on to the second part of the book, called The Horrors of Metaphysics. And the first chapter, chapter 7, is called The Black Tide, Mysticism, Rationality, and the German Occult Revival. And here you walk us through German post-Kantianism and psychoanalysis, and you show their theoretical and practical entanglements with the epoch's occult revival. And I particularly enjoyed the section on Freud, who, you know, upon first glance doesn't fit your story, but you show that he was indeed very much interested in the occult and the paranormal. Can you just briefly say something about Freud's relationship to all of this?
Yeah. So first, to take a step back in case the reader or the listener might have missed this. The book as a whole, I'm trying to work systematically through the different human sciences. So I'm going through. So if you're wondering like why it sounds like it's jumping disciplines a lot, what I'm looking at is the moment in which each of these disciplines internalized the notion of modernity as rupture, and modernity as rupture defined in terms of despiritualization or disenchantment. So, but yeah. So this chapter, it's about the birth of psychoanalysis, and particularly post-Kantian German philosophy. And I focus in on the figure of Sigmund Freud. And Sigmund Freud, people probably know if they've read your Freud that he criticizes primitive belief in the omnipotence of thought. And he criticized, you know, primitive belief in so-called in telepathy and described it as backward and what have you. And then the surprise is that Freud himself came to believe in the very things he associated with the primitive. So if you look at unpublished writings of his, if you look at letters and diaries, which I do in this chapter, Freud himself actually like went to seances. He performed at seances. He came to believe that there was something real, some kind of real occult knowledge. And ultimately he came convinced of the reality of telepathy. So, I mean, and so part of this chapter is about how that happened in Freud and how the normal account of the split between Freud and Jung turns out to be a Jung's myth, but a story that Jung told about Freud, but doesn't historically fit the data. But it talks about I'm interested in particularly how a kind of neo-Kantianism came to inform early psychoanalysis, how notions of depth and psychological depth were articulated, once Kant articulates a certain kind of notion of the limits of reason, people start to worry about exactly like, okay, what are those limits? What's below reason? What is the unconscious? What is the nature of the thing itself? And I note that influential thinkers in that historical trajectory and I'm thinking here particularly of Arthur Schopenhauer. Schopenhauer is like, was hugely influential again in his own day, in philosophy. He's one of the main influences on Nietzsche. He's an early influence on Freud. He's an early neo-Kantian, basically. Schopenhauer comes to believe in magic, and this is even in published works, which I'm surprised that people just haven't emphasized, but Schopenhauer literally advocates for the reality of magic and for animal magnetism, and he associates it with his famous concept of the will and what have you. So you have this notion. So what's interested in that chapter is how you have this interplay between notions of the mind and stories about disenchantment, alongside the resurgence of belief in various kinds of occult powers. And in that chapter also, I look at historically the beginning of this German occult revival, which coincides and parallels in some respects the rise of neo-Kantianism. It just timing-wise, it does. And so, and I even talk about Kant's own writings on Swedenborg in a famous text, Dreams of the Spirit Seer, which Kant on purpose had excluded from his corpus of reissued writings. It was like the last work of his pre-critical period, as he claimed. But it's an interesting engagement with Swedenborg and a kind of mysticism. So, I mean, part of what I'm trying to do is it's a method that I'm doing in all the chapters, but I'm looking at, in this case, how Freud and psychoanalysis starts to articulate this notion that magical thinking is crazy thinking in the very moment when Freud is himself engaging in magical thinking and knows that many of his peers, sophisticated, educated peers, have similar kinds of beliefs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's so interesting and really surprising. And the next chapter, chapter 8, called Dialectic of Darkness, The Magical Foundations of Critical Theory. And here you try to sketch for us some of the more esoteric origins of the Frankfurt School. And in particular, you examine the neo-pagan philosopher Ludwig Klages, who formulated a critique of modernity as domination of nature that was hugely influential for the Frankfurt School. And then you also walk us through some of Walter Benjamin's philosophy, and you persuasively argue that it's filled with magic, esotericism, mysticism, and a range of enchantments. And I was wondering if you could just share with listeners a little bit more about these figures and the origins of the Frankfurt School.
So this was in one version of the book. This was like the last chapter because I was like trying to work my way up to Adorno and Horkheimer. And one of the things that struck me at the very beginning of this project is that in Dialectic of Enlightenment, Adorno and Horkheimer cite this pagan mystic named Ludwig Klages. That was weird to me. Like, I'm like, why are they citing this guy who is famous for founding a group or being the co-founder of a group called the Munich Cosmic Circle and who had a whole, you know, he's a kind of a philosophical pagan, basically. And then I started to read Klages's writings, and they Klages has a kind of early ecological critique and even ecological feminism in his writings. And he's got an idea of a primordial matriarchy, and he has a critique of modernity as stripping nature of its agency, and a lot of things that we will think of as hallmarks of critical theory, even some of the kind of critical theory that I use myself, but to find articulated early and systematically, as early as like around 1910, in the writings of a neo-pagan mystic, that was like, whoa, that was mind-blowing. And then I discovered that like Walter Benjamin was obsessed with Klages, and he moved to Munich hoping to study with Klages, and he cites Klages all over the place, and they're in dialogue with each other, and he met with him a bunch of times. So like the link, you know, between the two was, you know, really tight. And then once you start looking at Walter Benjamin's work with this kind of eye, when you're looking, you start to think, okay, he must have known something about the occult world. Then what you see is like Benjamin is referencing to auras and constellations and what have you, and erotic rush and stuff like that. These are all concepts that and angels, all these are things that are happening and being discussed in the Western esoteric milieu in the moment that Benjamin is coming to his most famous theories. And so you can see kind of Benjamin's notion of the aura as in dialogue with not just Klages, but a whole kind of moment of Western esotericism. And so the other piece that I want to I do in this chapter too is, you know, provide, you know, sort of in that respect, the background of Adorno and Horkheimer's Dialectic of Enlightenment. And then I also show that like a certain narrative in critical theory that we keep repeating, you know, doesn't go back to the people we think authored it. It was authored first by this sort of problematic neo-pagan mystic. And I say problematic because Klages turns out to have a lot of features that I think are admirable. And he says some really fascinating things about the environment or what have you. But he turns out to have also been a rabid anti-Semite. And that's, I mean, especially at a couple points, it seems to be in some respects a metaphorical anti-Semitism, but he doesn't tone it down when real Jews' lives are at stake. And for me personally, you know, I had a quite strong negative reaction to that, but I want to say, you know, you can't deny that that's part of Klages, but that doesn't mean you should, throw all out everything he says based on some kind of a reductive fallacy. And the interesting thing to me is, and I don't articulate it very much in this particular chapter, but that there turns out to be a left-wing anti-Semitism in the period, which I didn't know about until kind of doing this research. But, you know, like there's a critique of the Jews that looks like a critique of 1%. It's a critique of capitalism. It's a critique of rootlessness. It's a critique of the idea that that a certain kind of banking conglomeration is controlling all of modernity, which is then racialized in these really problematic and screwed up ways. So and it was surprising to me to see that. And then people obviously like Walter Benjamin, who were themselves Jewish, and try and have to grapple with that. And then what he does is obviously strip out the anti-Semitism and even the paganism out from Clagas, and then, you know, does his own stuff. And I really like Walter Benjamin, and I teach him, and I identify with those Frankfurt School figures, him and Adorno. So but anyway, yeah. So then to see those roots, it's interesting, you know, it's fascinating. And I think the piece I want to often say when I teach, when I've talked out this piece a bunch, is that people assume that the occult is right wing. And what, they think occult Nazis, like that's a widespread trope. But it turns out you can find occult beliefs on both sides of the aisle. So you can find left-wing occultists who are resisting the Nazis, and the Nazis shut down certain kinds of occultism, even as there were Nazi occultists who were themselves promoting other kinds of occultism. So it's not as binary as one or the other. And so occultism is running around the period in Britain, in Germany, and in France. And you have anti-Semitism, unfortunately, in the period, and running around in all three of those countries, too. And so, yeah, and sometimes those co-occur and sometimes those don't. Yeah.
Perfect. Great. The next chapter, chapter 9, called The Ghosts of Metaphysics, Logical Positivism, and Disenchantment. This was something that I was waiting for ever since I read in the intro where you write, the Vienna School philosophers seem to be the worst candidates for closet magicians. And indeed, they really do appear, you know, again on first glance, to be almost antithetical to your argument. But you show through their writings, their letters, their personal biographies, that they indeed belong to your argument, and that some of them were really obsessed with the paranormal from a variety of different angles. And so I was wondering if you could situate the Vienna School in its esoteric milieu. And yeah, maybe tell us about Hans Hahn's interest in the paranormal, or Carnap's interest in the paranormal.
Yeah. So I came to this chapter like, I don't know how you're trained, but when I was, you know, I spent a lot of my formative years going to these trendy lectures in Paris by whatever philosopher was trending. And often they would attack positivists. That would be, you wouldn't exactly know who the positivists were, but you got a vague sense that like the bad guys were positivists. And when I started reading German critical theory, you see that really even more amplified. So Adorno and Horkheimer, again, they like attack, they're more specific about it being in a way the Vienna Circle of logical positivism that they're attacking. But, you know, they're also attacking positivism. And so what the surprise, so I thought, and often a lot of the critique of positivism is that it's supposed to be like the crystallization of disenchantment. It's like stripping the world of all kind of meaning and poetry and making everything into kind of materialism or what have you. And then the surprise is if you look at the lives of these significant positivists, both lesser known positivists like Otto Neurath and more famous people like Hans Hahn and Rudolf Carnap, you can see like an engagement with the paranormal. Neurath is even calling positivism magic, and he's talking about it as a magical way of thinking. It doesn't fit the received picture at all. I mean, in Carnap, there's this really telling moment, and I don't have a lot of time, so I'll go quick. There's a really telling moment there, when you look at the archive. If you look at interviews around, you know, Rudolf Carnap and Wittgenstein have this famous split. In a way, it's like it's supposed to be the thing that causes Wittgenstein to then become like the late Wittgenstein. He, like, the one story is that Wittgenstein turns in against his own previous thinking after seeing how Carnap and company are abusing it or whatever. But if you look at accounts of that split, both by Carnap himself and then interviews and other writings, what happens, the turning moment is that, like, basically Wittgenstein sees on Carnap's bookshelves all these books about the paranormal and psychical research. And Wittgenstein is like, what? Why are you reading this psychical research or whatever? And he's like, so he wants to dismiss it, but Carnap is like really interested in the possibility of the existence of spirits. Even if he's probably more inclined to disenchant than enchant them, he's fascinated, he's drawn to it, he's drawn to seances, etc. And in the same moment that Wittgenstein dismisses Carnap for potentially believing in the existence of spirits, Carnap is going to dismiss Wittgenstein because Wittgenstein is interested in mysticism. So, and Wittgenstein explicitly refers to his stuff as mystic. So, it's this weird, it's this interesting moment. It's an example of one of the things that I observe in the book, which is that people who believe different kinds of paranormal belief often are very critical of each other. So part of the way that you get these partial kinds of disenchantments functioning in different discursive domains is that, like, you know, the people who believe in the reality of demonic possession and the people who believe in psychic powers each think that the other is silly often, you know? So you get the people who believe in demonic possession think that the psychic power stuff is actually caused by the devil, or the people who believe in psychic powers believe that the people who believe in demonic possession are really describing some kind of invisible force or spirits or what have you. And so they kind of cancel each other out in a very interesting way. And so it was interesting to me to be able to see that in and among the world of the positivists. And again, you know, I kind of got a reappraisal of them. I kind of found them much more interesting than I thought they were going to be when I did that chapter. It was almost on a dare, that chapter, because a buddy of mine thought that also that they were the least likely people to have had any of those kind of beliefs. And then, you know, I went to looking at diaries and letters and stuff, and it just all this stuff came out. So it's a fun chapter to write and gave me more reading about analytic philosophy than I had done before.
I think that's good. So we are running out of time. So I'm just going to just sort of like alert to listeners what goes on in the final chapter, which is called The World of Enchantment, or Max Weber at the End of History. So in this chapter, you know, you come to the person who is probably most famously associated with disenchantment and the disenchantment thesis. You go through a lot of his writings, a lot of his private writings, letters, and you come up with some really interesting arguments and points. One fascinating thing that really shocked me was that you argued that Weber might have come to the concept of disenchantment, or what you call disenchanting, after spending some time at a Swiss neo-pagan commune. So I will leave to listeners to find out more in that chapter. And I just wanted to quickly jump to the conclusion and just sort of ask you a really broad question, but obviously we have time constraints. Why are the human sciences so critical to the history of myth, magic, and modernity?
So, I mean, so what I'm interested in, and what one of the things that originally inspired this project, is I'm trying to figure out, I'm grappling with, let's call our postmodern moment. And one of the things that I was interested in was how we got the story that modernity meant a kind of rupture, that the there's a moment where, you know, like, the things are very different between pre-modernity and modernity, or even if you're going to later add a postmodern period at the end of it, there's this idea of modernity as this kind of break. And the place that I see that being most systematically articulated was in the human sciences. And this is, of course, a category I'm getting from the German Gustav Wissenschaften, but basically like the humanities and social sciences together. That's where you start to get this narrative that defines modernity, and often European modernity in particular, as this break. And I was skeptical of it. In part, I'm trying to work through and past postmodernism. And so one of the things I was interested in was all these various accounts of modernity as rupture, and that those are the disciplines that it gets done in. And I don't even get to complete the project in a way, in that, like, I could have kept writing an even longer book. Like, I look at not just Germany and France. I had a chapter on the birth of academic philosophy departments in America and how they're connected to monist leagues. But wow. I had to cut that. I have a long chapter on the birth of sociology in France and Auguste Comte and his own connection to spiritualism and fetishism, so-called. He defines the term and then comes to sort of fall into his own conceptual horizon. So, I mean, there's a lot of work that could be done there. And it basically, part of it is an attempt to excavate the actual cultural history of the 19th and 20th century and tell it in a new way. If you look back at the past without assuming that the central feature of modernity it being disenchantment or secularization, you start to see all these other things that you didn't notice before. And not only, you know, we can find it, you know, in the writings of, we can find writings of mystics or New Age figures or theosophists or spirituals, but then to find it in the writings of the scholars themselves or in the social worlds of scholars themselves was for me really exciting and important as a way to kind of undo a particular story about modernity.
Great. That's a perfect way to end. Really quickly, what are you working on right now?
So originally I conceived of this as part of a two-part project called The Past and Futures of the Human Sciences. But then I discovered that the past part wasn't what I wanted to tell about history, wasn't what I wanted to tell about the future. The next project isn't particularly on Western esotericism. The book I'm working on now, and it's out for peer review as we speak, so knock on wood, is called Absolute Disruption, The Future of Theory After Postmodernism. And it's an attempt to figure out how to formulate a kind of new social science, let's say a post-Kuhnian social science, in the wake of or after the collapse of post-structuralism. It's really about, like, how to do, what kind of methodologies we might pursue, having disintegrated a bunch of master categories and having come You know, like I was someone who, you know, got Derrida in college, and you know, I you know, so for us, the things that were themselves counter-hegemonic, the critiques of the mainstream categories like Derrida and Foucault, etc., were taught as the dominant thing. And so what I want to know is, how do we move beyond them in a way that's not a reversal? I'm not trying to retreat to a discredited modernism, but actually trying to move through or move past post-structuralism or post-modernism by turning it inside out. So it's a methodological work. It's more philosophical. This book was basically me taking Foucault's techniques and using them on Adorno and Horkheimer. And now what I want to do is kind of undo my own methodological structures and then try and do something that's not a deconstructive project, but actually a constructive project. So that's what I'm doing in the next work. So hopefully it's called Absolute Disruption, and you can find some more information about it probably online. But anyway, yeah, that's what I'm working on now.
Well, thank you so much. I look forward to seeing your new book, and take care.
Thank you. Pleasure chatting.